Good afternoon, everyone. The Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs, Finance, and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. To the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang.
Present.
Representative Detmer.
Detmer, present.
Representative McDonald.
Present.
Representative Berg. Berg excused. Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Frederick. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Representative Sundin.
Present.
Representative Frederick. And we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes from the February 16th, 2021 meeting. Every member should have received a copy of today's minutes in their inbox. Representative Zhang, would you care to move the minutes? We'll try somebody else. Representative Nelson, would you care to move the minutes?
I'll move the minutes from the previous meeting.
Representative Nelson moves the minutes from February 16th, 2021. Any comments or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. The minutes are adopted. First bill on the agenda today is House File 592 from Representative Christensen. I will move that House File 592 be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Representative Christensen, 2-year bill.
Representative Christensen, you're on mute still.
Oh, God, wouldn't you think I'd learned by now? House File 592 is an authorization to establish a stable housing initiative, a classification of data. State agencies, councils, and groups across Minnesota work to identify and provide services for individuals and families experiencing homelessness. In partnership with the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs has developed the Homeless Veterans Registry. The registry assembles a team of housing and service professionals who work together to help veterans on a case-by-case basis to access housing and services to meet their needs. Data for individuals experiencing homelessness is classified as private data under Minnesota Statute 13.587. The result is a limitation which has led to a fragmented and inefficient response to time-sensitive crisis situations for individuals and families experiencing homelessness. This proposal classifies data on individuals on the Homeless Veterans Registry as private and authorizes the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs to share or disclose an individual's data to coordinate homelessness prevention efforts with MICH members and Homeless Veterans Registry partners to respond quickly to an individual experiencing homelessness or at risk of homelessness. The intent of the bill is to drastically increase the timeliness and the efficiency of addressing the needs of individual veterans experiencing homelessness in Minnesota. Streamlining the processes and procedures allowing for quicker response times to veterans in crisis. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, you're muted.
Just like Representative Christensen, yes. You think I know by now. Anyway, I'll start over. First testifier is Andrew Jarvis, Director of Veterans Benefits and Services, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Jarvis, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair, committee members. My name is Andy Jarvis. I'm the Director of Veterans Programs and Memorial Affairs with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I appreciate you hearing our testimony today. First, I want to start with a little background and introduction into our team and the registry process, and then I'll turn it over to one of our team members, Sloan, who's going to dive a little deeper and let you know why this is such a critical problem for us now and how we've dealt with it in the past. So in early 2014, when the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness was really getting stood up, there was a subcommittee on data. And we all met representatives from multiple different agencies, Department of Corrections, DOT, DHS, ourselves, in a conference room at Minnesota Housing Finance Agency to discuss how we were going to use data to inform and end homelessness for all populations throughout the state of Minnesota. And in that meeting, we stood up and said, well, we can't end homelessness in the state of Minnesota unless we understand who is homeless. And so what we need is a list of anyone in the state that is homeless so we can triage them. And much to our surprise, there was a lot of negative feedback from many of the state agencies. You can't share data. There's no way we'd be able to do that. It's too restrictive. And we really walked away with that meeting with an understanding that we were committed to ending veteran homelessness within the state of Minnesota, and that we were going to do something. And within 9 months later, at the end of 2014, we launched our Minnesota State Veterans Homeless Registry. And it's been a great success. To date, we've had 2,170 housing outcomes since December of 2014. That's how many individuals that we've helped through this by name list. It's become a national best practice. We've presented at national homeless conferences in DC to many other partners on our registry. We've packaged it up and sent it off to other states and agencies. We've worked with the state of Missouri, worked with MEC Council on their transportation, homeless population on transportation systems. And we've really aligned our efforts with the federal benchmarks to end veteran homelessness and become the fourth state to do so. Over the years, our team has grown. This effort really started out as an ancillary meeting on the director's calendar. And now we have a team of eight individuals led by a supervisor. That growth has afforded us a lot of opportunities to do some amazing things. We're an integral member of the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. And a lot of what we do here with the veteran population is very forward-leaning, innovative, collaborative, and it serves as a model for our other populations within the state of Minnesota on what can be done and the possible pathways for those populations to end their episode. And we lead all of the subpopulations as far as getting as close to functional zero as possible. Our team was integrally involved in our efforts this summer to clear out the homeless encampments when we had the period of civil unrest and get those most vulnerable populations in hotels and immediate shelters. Within 4 hours of a conference call on a Saturday, our team showed up with school buses and helped clear out those encampments. And we had team members at the hotels waiting and ready to get those individuals housing. I'm very proud of our talented team. We have individuals with master's degrees in public policy, JDs. We've influenced public policy at local levels of government all across the state. to deliver results. Six out of the 10 continuums of care, which are geographical regions within the state, have ended veteran homelessness. And to put that another way, 71 out of 87 counties in Minnesota have declared an end to veteran homelessness. So we've done a lot of great work. The most recent COC to declare was the suburban metro area counties. So that has, you know, Anoka, Washington, and all of the metro counties except for Hennepin and Ramsey. We made that declaration on Veterans Day of 2020. And we're really proud to be able to make that accomplishment in the metro area in the middle of a pandemic with historic low vacancy rates and an eviction moratorium. But truth be told, with all of the amazing things that we've accomplished, all the innovation and collaboration that we've been able to do, the talented team members that I have, the fact that we only have 16 remaining counties left, these four remaining COCs have the hardest to house populations. It's the most transient population, and it's really critical now more than ever that we're able to share data on these individuals with our key partners to make these immediate and on the spot decisions and connections to services and housing supports that they need. And with that, I want to turn it over to Sloan, who's going to highlight a little more of this issue and why it's so critical now.
Thank you, Mr. Jarvis. Next up is Sloan Kessler, Homeless Programs Coordinator, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Kessler, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair, committee members, thank you so much for having me here this afternoon. My name is Sloan Kessler, and I am a homeless programs coordinator with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And I'm here today to testify really on the importance of this bill for our work. So the policy proposal that you have in front of you is twofold. The first component of the bill really is to establish this stable housing initiative, which is very important for us at our work at MDVA. It really is here to highlight, we're here to highlight the importance of the interagency nature of this work and all of the work that we do with the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness and all of the different agencies that participate in the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness, and also really to codify, to put into law that this mission is a shared mission with all these agencies, as well as to show the support of legislature to be that the next state, the fourth state, to end veteran homelessness. And then I really wanted to talk mostly about the difficulty that we have in sharing data with our partners and why it's so crucial for the work that we do. As Andy really laid the framework out for us, we're working with a very transient population. The staff that works with these individuals day in and day out know that sometimes this is the only touch point they might have with an individual experiencing homelessness. Because someone might be willing to ask for help one day doesn't mean that their homelessness goes away the next day, or that they might be able to, you know, have that connection with that person the next day. They don't know where they're getting their next meal, what they're going to do, how they're going to stay alive, stay well in that situation. And so they're looking for a place that they can, you know, rest, a place that all of this work happens. And so we know that homelessness is an emergency and it should be treated as such in these very, very dire situations. And so the policy proposal we have here helps us to provide that coordination with our partners very quickly. It allows for us to work alongside of all of our amazing partners across the state of Minnesota that do this work, and really be able to provide the services at the time that they're needed for these individuals so that we can get them housed. Something that I do want to highlight about the language here is that all this data is classified as private data. There's no change in the classification of data, not looking at anything that touches Chapter 13 besides just a reference to the data that's already classified as private. And I want to really highlight this by giving an example of something that has recently come up in the work that we've been doing. We were approached by a national nonprofit that was partnering with Chase Bank that came to us and said, we really like the work that you're doing. We want to help, and we have $100,000 for you to work with to end homelessness and veteran homelessness in Hennepin County. And we were very excited to partner to, you know, help make as many connections as possible. It was a really rare and quick opportunity. But what we realized is that it was going to be extremely difficult for us to make that partnership work. There were a lot of different administrative type hurdles that were going to be really difficult for us because this partner agency that was able to do the work in Hennepin County was not identified previously as a partner agency for us with the registry. So that means going through the process of having different MOU agreements, different types of contracts that needed to be signed, different versions of things that we needed to have in place, which we would do for any partnership that we have. It was just one of those very cumbersome processes that, with the help of this language and this legislation, we would be able to accomplish that mission very quickly so that we can serve the veterans that so desperately need our help very, very fast. There are currently 275 individuals on the registry. All of them sign a Tennyson warning. And with this process, this would help us immensely not have to, every time a partner is added to our homeless veteran registry partner list, go back to all 275 individuals that are experiencing homelessness and have them re-sign each version of the Tennyson with additional partner agencies. So we're really looking here with this bill to streamline our process and to get veterans the help that they need when they need it and as quickly and as efficiently as possible. I'm available for questions. And I believe Andy is also available for any additional questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kessler. And I apologize for the wrong introduction at the start of your testimony. Member questions, Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And thank you, Representative Christensen, for bringing this forward. I know we started working on homelessness many years ago with different commissioners that have come through the system here. And I think the state of Minnesota is probably ahead of many other states. And I know the topic of Tennyson warning notice was just brought up. And maybe I know this is an important part of this bill in terms of, in the Minnesota statute, section 13.04 and subdivision 2 we're talking about here. And maybe we should maybe look into what must the notice include, and what it does not include. And maybe, I don't know if the author of the bill, Representative Christensen, if you've looked into that or not, if you could share that with us, or maybe some of your testifiers can.
To the author or the testifiers.
I defer to Andy. Do you have a response to that?
Mr. Jarvis.
Mr. Chair, representatives, Great question. So we plan on to continue to use a Tennyson notice for all of our veterans. In that Tennyson, it says explicitly, you know, what data we're collecting, how we're going to use that data in essence to end their episode of homelessness. So that won't continue to change. What this will do is allow us to share data on these veterans, which is still classified private, with our partners on the Homeless Veteran Registry and other members of MITCH, which are other state agencies like DHS and Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and allow us to do it more rapidly. Anytime we bring on a partner to the Homeless Veteran Registry, they have to sign a memorandum of understanding. That memorandum of understanding gets reviewed every 2 years to ensure that all parties are meeting their obligations. Those obligations include informing us immediately of any staffing changes, of individuals that maybe had access to the Homeless Veteran Registry to access data or input data, so we can ensure that we're granting and removing the appropriate permissions as those staffing changes happen. But to the point of Tennyson, it'll always be used, and in there we describe you know, why we're using their data, and we're not changing the classification of the data. So Representative Detmer, I don't know if that answered all components of your question. If there's anything that's missing, I'd love the opportunity to address that.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Jarvis. What does what happens if the government does not provide the notice? What will happen? Is there problems there that we have?
Mr. Jarvis.
What would happen if we don't get the veteran's signature? I mean, because we always provide the notice. If we've made contact with a veteran, whether it's reading the Tennyson verbally or if it's in person and having a signature, which allows us to collect that data. I mean, I guess if we didn't have a notice, we wouldn't be collecting data on that individual.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I know we found out we've experienced in the past over the years that many times the homeless veterans don't want to be involved in a program. And how do you approach that? I know that's probably a difficult situation. Some veterans try to avoid the government and so forth, agencies. So how are you able to work with veterans to bring them in so that they can be helped?
Mr. Jarvis or Ms. Kessler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, a great question. You know, so our team is really a multimodal team. We bring in partners from all sectors. We have, you know, nonprofits like MACV. We have representatives from DEED. We have teams that are standing by to get them connected to the VA Medical Center or other healthcare services. So, yes, often you may find a veteran that doesn't necessarily want to work with government, but they may be willing to work with a nonprofit. There's, you know, it could be a myriad of problems that are triggering their episode of homelessness or continued episodes of homelessness. And we have ways and different programming to address all of those, whether it's unemployment, underemployment, mental health, chemical addiction. And it's, while there's a small population of individuals who are chronically homeless, it is their choice on how they want to move forward in their housing plan or sometimes their lack thereof. But we've always strived to be there for those individuals and to just maintain a constant presence, because often you'll find that when they're ready to make the decision, you know, we want to be there and we want them to know who to come to. And so sometimes it's just a street outreach worker making contact with that individual, you know, every month and just say, you know, hey, I'm just checking in. I want to see if there's anything I can do for you, and building that rapport with that individual. And when that rapport is built, you've established trust, and usually you can engage with the individuals then.
Representative Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we all can say hats off to the MDVA for the work they've done in the past and the work they're going to be doing in the future to eliminate homelessness for our veterans population. How many, maybe you might have mentioned this already, how many counties have we already eliminated homelessness out of the 87 counties? Do you have that available for us?
Mr. Jarvis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer. So to date, we have 71 out of the 87 counties have effectively ended veteran homelessness and reached functional zero. So functional zero doesn't mean that we won't or don't have homeless individuals in those areas, but it means that we can rapidly house those individuals within 90 days, and we have the infrastructure in place to support them.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Jarvis.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Christensen, I've been studying these Tennyson warning notices because, quite honestly, I didn't know an awful lot about it. And my question is there ever a time when a government entity does not have to give a Tennyson warning notice?
Deferred to Representative
Christensen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Jarvis.
I'm not familiar with any situation where a state agency doesn't have to give a Tennyson notice unless there's some kind of exemption for emergencies. But we've always operated under the premise and have always given a Tennyson notice to any veteran on the Homeless Veteran Registry.
Representative Poston, I see, just a second, Representative Poston, I see Ben Johnson from MDVA might have a comment on that as well. Mr. Johnson.
Chair Eklund, members of the committee, I'm Ben Johnson. I'm the legislative director for MDVA. Representative Poston, to your question, we actually could thank Representative Detmer for pointing out statutes 13.04, subdivision 2. The final sentence in that, in subdivision 2, is that the requirements for providing a Tennyson warning shall not apply when an individual is asked to supply investigative data. So there is that specific exemption. Tennyson warnings are not required for investigatory purposes, sir.
Representative Poston.
Thank you for the education, Mr. Johnson. I appreciate it, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I don't see any other member questions. I want to thank the MDVA for their effort and outreach on doing this. When I was fortunate enough to be named chair of this committee 2 years ago, two of the prime focuses I wanted to work on were veterans' mental health and veterans' homelessness, and I think this is a good start. I'm glad that we're working towards functional zero. Representative Christensen, any final comments on your bill?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I also want to thank the folks from MDVA and my testifiers. I, too, have learned a lot from them. So it's an amazing program that they have going here, and I hope we can help it get to the finish line. This passed last year, actually, on a bipartisan basis through this committee, but then we got hit by this thing called COVID, and things were sort of derailed for a while. It was carried by Senator Swedzinski in the Senate, and it has passed on a bipartisan basis through both the committees over there. So I urge everyone to vote yes. Thanks much.
I will renew my motion that House File 592 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Yes.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Aye.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
Aye.
McDonald, aye. Representative Berg. Berg, excused. Representative Bliss.
Yes.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. And there are 12 ayes, one excused.
12-0, Representative Christensen, you're on your way to judiciary.
Thanks all. Thanks much.
Next on the bill and agenda is House File 478 from Representative Feist. I will move the House File 478 be referred to Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committees. Representative Feist, two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and nice to see you, committee. I am honored to be carrying the Veterans Restorative Justice Act. This bill creates a statewide access to a specialized restorative sentencing structure for eligible veterans who have committed lower-level criminal offense as a direct result of a service-related condition. This bill has the support of a broad coalition of stakeholders, including prosecutors, defense attorneys, veterans groups, as well as victims' advocates, including Violence Free Minnesota. This bill makes us safer through impressive reduced recidivism by providing support to veterans to confront their acts, seek the treatment that they need and deserve, and to rejoin the community of law-abiding citizens. Attorney Ryan Ells will be walking through the bill in detail, but I'd like to emphasize a few elements of the bill at the outset. In talking about this bill with victims' advocacy groups, they've appreciated the requirement of a direct nexus between the criminal behavior and a service-related injury or trauma. This isn't a get-out-of-jail-free card for veterans. The restorative approach is rigorous, as will be described by the testifiers today. It would be much easier to accept a guilty plea and serve out a probation passively. By selecting the restorative approach to sentencing, the veteran is choosing to confront their actions, seek treatment that they need, and commit to achieving their full potential in life. And lastly, I just want to point out that this restorative approach to sentencing of veterans is projected to save $1.2 million. While it sounds like a huge investment, the savings to the courts vastly exceed the investment in the long run. And I'd like to end my introduction with a quote from a constituent of mine who emailed me when she saw that I introduced this bill. She wrote, "My father was in World War II. He came home crazy and got no help. My mother tried to get help, but to no avail. His alcoholism and PTSD made our family life hell. No one and no family should ever have to suffer like we and millions of others have suffered. If my dad had been able to get all the aspects of treatment courts, his life could have been turned around and our family could have thrived." I am so honored to be carrying this bill, and I'm excited to have Mr. Ells walk through the bill in detail because there's a lot there. And then we also have two graduates of veteran treatment courts, as well as a mentor coordinator from Anoka's Veterans Courts, although I didn't see his name, so hopefully he's here. So thank you. Oh, there you are. Hello. And I will pass this on to the testifiers. If Mr. L could, or I'll let you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Feist. First testifier is Ryan Ells. Mr. Ells, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair and committee members, my name is Ryan Ells, and I am a practicing criminal defense attorney, legislative chair of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and a veteran myself. Thank you for giving me some time today to explain this bill. This bill is a product of a couple years of work with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, the Chief Public Defender, and the representatives of the state and federal VA. And we, when all those bodies agree, I think we're on to something that is worth consideration. This bill would use the stay of adjudication sentence, which is used thus far mostly in drug cases. It's you may be familiar with it under Minnesota Statute 15218 as the mechanism by which drug offenders are rehabilitated. And we want to apply the same model to offenses up to severity level 7 felonies in cases involving veterans whose service-related disorder directly led to the offense. The veteran would have the burden of showing the connection between the offense and the condition. And at that point, they would enter a plea. that plea would be held by the court, not entered on the record, and the court would lay out a probationary term of treatment that the veteran would be expected to complete. At the end of that probationary period, the veteran would then have to stand in front of the judge and defend that their performance on probation and prove to that judge that they were rehabilitated before they would get the benefit of dismissal of the offense. If that were the case, after a hearing with prosecutor, the victim, and the veteran, and the judge did find that they had earned the dismissal, the case would be dismissed and the veteran would be able to move on without a record of conviction. This gives the incentive to get through the very difficult trauma treatment that's involved in dealing with very severe combat trauma, as we see a lot of our veterans coming back from multiple tours in very high intensity combat zones. That trauma that they're dealing with is cumulative, and they are having to dig back into the most painful memories of their entire life over and over again until they get to a point that's comfortable. The only way we can expect that that's going to happen is to give them a legal incentive that is commensurate with that challenge. I myself have served in combat. I had some issues that came home with me. The only way I got through the treatment was being threatened with divorce. And I can remember sitting outside the therapist's office, gripping my steering wheel, not wanting to go in and talk about it. And the only way I did it is I said, there's going to be a really bad consequence if I don't. And this is both a carrot and a stick to get these veterans through the treatment they need.
Thank you, Mr. Ellis. If you can please stick around in case there's questions, I'd appreciate it. Next up is Lee Alfords. Mr. Alfords, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Maybe
Mr. Alfords, I think you're muted. We will come back to Mr. Alfords in a minute. We'll figure out the technical troubles. Mr. Alfords, if you can hang on, thank you. Next up, we'll call, and if I butcher your name, I apologize, Chris Vinden. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed. Oh, Mr. Alfords, are you there now?
I am here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Alfords, please identify yourself.
My name is Lee
Alfords. Yourself and proceed.
I am a combat veteran from Vietnam. I must say that I am not proud to say that I graduated from Veterans Court, and it's not something I ever wanted to do, but it turned out to be one of the best things I've ever had happen. When I came home from Vietnam in 1970, I came home with many of the problems that Vietnam veterans had. I have suffered from PTSD since that time. And since there was no help available, obviously all we could do was stuff that inside and hope we could be a productive member of society. For years, I was afraid of the terror of the night, which any combat veteran can tell you. When the house goes silent, there are no lights on, and your brain takes you back to the time of not a good time. I found that alcohol was a very easy sedative, and by consuming enough of that, that terror of the night would go away. Obviously, that was not a good thing for my driving record, and in 2012, I was arrested for a DWI with a blood alcohol content of 0.21 and was subsequently assigned to Veterans Court. While veterans, I realize that this bill does not set up Veterans Court. For me, the Veterans Court set me on the road on a path that I would have never taken on my own. I was required to meet with a judge once a week for 1 year. I was required to enter the VA alcohol substance abuse program. And for the first time in my life, I found peace. I found out the reasons why I needed alcohol, and I was able to lay that down. I am just so grateful for what I went through. This program, as I understand it, does not set up veterans court, but it does set up a veterans advocate. And that veterans advocate appears between the judge and the veteran and presents the veteran's case to the judge, who then determines what the veteran must do. And the veteran must adhere to very rigid schedules, as I did. But if he does, all of this can go away, and he can continue to lead his life. It amazes me that this bill has had so many problems trying to get through the legislature. I noticed when we said the Pledge of Allegiance earlier that one of the phrases is "and justice for all." I am hoping, and all the veterans that are watching this bill hope, that this will help veterans get justice also. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Alfords. Please stick around in case there's questions. Next up, Chris Binden. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of HF 478. My name is Chris Binden. I'm from East Bethel, Minnesota. Currently employed as a homeless outreach county veteran service officer, providing housing and resources to veterans within the metro area. I served in the United States Marine Corps 2002 to 2010. Service included combat deployments to Iraq, North Africa, Ukraine, and humanitarian aid to Katrina and New Orleans in 2005. My military occupational specialty consisted of performance duties required within 1,300 combat engineer field and provisional security guard. Included construction of tactical air refueling systems, fuel supply convoys, route to clearance patrols in search of improvised explosive devices roadside, clearing paths for other Marine convoys. It's provisional security duties. I ran, conducted patrols in up-armored Humvees, acted as a machine gutter, vehicle undercarriage searches, in addition to providing security for naval master of arms and canine searching for explosives. When returning home in 2010, it wasn't long after I got out, I acquired back-to-back DUIs without even driving. Without even driving, and I quickly found out that being in control of a motorized vehicle is the same as a DUI. But I was also homeless. That was caused due to ID theft that occurred while I was overseas. And it was more than just check fraud that occurred to me. It ruined my credit, which caused a little dip from me obtaining an apartment and signing leases. So now, at this point, I was unemployed. I was unable to reenlist, sleeping in my van, and even though I wasn't supposed to because I had DUIs at this time, I finally had one more incident occur, and that's how I ended up in Ramsey County Veterans Court. That was in 2013. And what Veterans Court did was provide basically me to attend the type of mental therapy that I needed, because I was using alcohol to cope with, you know, any convoys ranging from 2 miles to 250 miles with IED threats, mortars, bullets in your vehicles. suicides that were occurring overseas amongst fellow Marines and soldiers that were stationed in the same post. Left my fiance after a big argument within 24 hours of me returning home. I remember the judge saying, you know, she looked at my record quick and she says, we need to make sure that this veteran gets the help that is needed. And I just happened to get lucky and was accepted into the Veterans Court. That was, what, late 2013, 2014. Veterans Court got me connected with the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. And like I mentioned earlier, I was attending, it was demanded that I attended the therapy appointments that were being provided by the VA. I had a therapist, psychologist, something that I needed. And the frequent UAs helped me stay accountable. Veterans Court provided me with a support network, which was great because when I came home from the Marines, it's like, I don't know if you've ever heard this before, but it's like you're separated from your tribe. And it just provided positive direction and mentorship. And fulfilling all the duties that, or I should say demands that Veterans Court expected of me. I was among the first to graduate in Ramsey County in 2015. Since then, I've become an asset to the community. I was recognized by Minnesota, by the Minnesota Humanities Center, and received the Veterans Voice Award for advocating among veteran homelessness in Minnesota in the TPT documentary called Crossing the Threshold. Additionally, helping advocating for other veterans looking for employment. We were ready to work. I appeared on WCCO advocating that veterans can work. This is the type of resources we need. Volunteer work with veteran nonprofits. I respond to crises, veterans in crisis in my free time. And since then, I've also taken on my responsibility or my role as a better father. I'm married. I've achieved my associate arts degree, my Bachelor of Arts in Social Work degree in order to help veterans. And I received an MBA in organizational development. That was all within 4-year span. I have a BA in social work without a license. I would have loved to have pursued my Master of Social Work and become a clinical therapist with my own clinic for veterans and even maybe emergency responders. However, with the felony conviction for DUIs, I have never been provided a straight answer and have not been able to obtain licensure to get licensed as a social worker, and that's why I went the MBA route. But I believe that if I not had that felony conviction, I could be a bigger asset in the community with that licensure to become, you know, providing more in-depth professional services for those in need. And I believe if passing HF 478, not only myself, but other veterans will become even a bigger asset to the community. Thank you. If there's any questions,
be glad to respond. Thank you, Mr. Binden and Semper Fi. Next on the agenda is our next testifier is Paul Evangelist. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed. Oh, you're still muted, Mr. There you go.
My name is Paul Evangelist.
Oh, you're muted, Mr. Evangelist.
Sorry.
I don't know if we're having some kind of technical difficulty here. The joys of Zoom, members, if we just be patient for a minute, Mr. Evangelist, or Mr. Reese, I don't know if we can help out there.
Here's there to be, you're unmuted now, Mr. Evangelist, if you want to start. I believe that you're ready.
Yes, my name is Paul Evangelist, and I am sorry about the technical difficulties. I think I'm the problem. So I want to speak to you today and share my thoughts about the Veterans Justice Restorative Justice Act. When I speak to you, I want to speak to you from the perspective of being a Vietnam veteran myself, United States Marine combat veteran, 1968 to 1970. Also a peer mentor coordinator for the Anoka County Veterans Court in my sixth year right now. And then I've also was a mentor in Anoka County and Hennepin County courts for last actually a total of about 8 years now. I've done both of those courts. So when I say my comments, I'll be coming from those particular areas. So here's a profile of a veteran that starts the court, particularly the one that I'm most familiar with is Anoka County Veterans Court. But when a veteran walked into the Anoka County Veterans Court for the first time, they're there because they have violated the law that has placed the public at risk. And they have broken the trust of the public, and they're aware that how they're living their lives is wrong. And at the same time, they're very cautious. But there is some sort of an urgency that's kind of striking them that says, I better make some change in order to try to do something different. So they really don't have a plan, nor do they really have any skills to necessarily put the plan together so what they choose to do is to volunteer for the court. And then in my mind, that's truly the very first step that they take to accept total personal responsibility for their post-traumatic stress disorder, their traumatic brain injury. Maybe it's the sexual military trauma that they're dealing with, or other mental health issues that they're facing, and it's because of their military experiences. That means it's no longer responsible for them to say that my wife should take care of this, or my children, or my parents, or my brother, or my sister, or something. It means that they have to start to take responsibility for themselves. It means that they can no longer use alcohol and use that to suppress their feelings or compress it in such a way so that they are driving around on the streets and the roads of the community, making it dangerous for other people. And it also means that domestic violence towards the people that they say they love is no longer the answer for the belly full of rage that they might be feeling, and they don't know how to deal with it. I've read the Veterans Restorative Justice Act many times, and I can see where it could be controversial, because I think it's possible to interpret the actions of the court to make it easier for the veteran because they are a veteran, and while they're under court supervision. I can tell you this, and I've seen this many, many times, that I see the court decision as the stay of sentence as a way to discontinue the argument about are they guilty or are they innocent? Okay. And make no mistake, the crime is not forgotten or lost in any way as the veteran participates in the court. The reason why the veteran is in the court may be entangled with their military experiences, but those reasons are not excuses for their behavior. So the Anoka County Veterans Treatment Court, using the model of the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, requires each veteran to go through a rigorous program which replaces punishment with rehabilitation. The program replaces a veteran's chaotic lifestyle with consistency, predictability, and lots of structure. in a fair but firm manner dismantle the man's progress and holds them accountable for their chaotic choices, even every step of the way. And that's something I've seen happen all the time with the veterans. So how did they change? And I think that's really important to emphasize. Almost right from the very start, veterans realized that successfully completing the court's expectations will be some of the hardest work they'll ever have to do in their whole lives. Veterans realize that changing in their lives places them on the continuum of wellness that is slow, demanding, painful, and ongoing. Gradually and over a timeline of 2 or more years, a circle of support from many disciplines begins to surround each veteran, and here are some of the things that begin to happen. So court-ordered treatment and services addressing sexual trauma, TBI, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance abuse, or other mental health problems stemming from military services are completed. Veterans start to understand how their needs can be met by themselves with help from others without being destructive in the community. New skills like goal setting, building a plan, asking for help, and selecting new friendships emerge and are utilized daily as their lifestyles change. Marginalized and illegal behaviors are replaced by lifelong community acceptable activities like sobriety, employment, schooling, housing, transportation, family building, and medication management. Avoidance. Isolation is replaced by community involvement. Avoidance is crowded out by engagement. And lack of trust is replaced by learning to trust others, especially those that are outside of the military. When a veteran graduates from a court or from an Anoka County Veterans Court, they look back and they sit there and say, how did I let it get so far out of my control? And every one of them is proud of how they have changed and believe that they can manage their lives in a different and much more positive manner. Close, I like to say that I'm passionate about veterans treatment courts and working with veterans, and I've been a mentor for a really long time. As a Vietnam veteran at age 72, since 1970, I know that I've had PTSD, and I know what it takes to change. And there's nothing easy about it, and the work that the veterans do in this court is really, really hard work. I know that myself and other veterans that have been part of the court watch up close as these veterans struggle, and they take personal responsibility for changing themselves. And I really do believe that's probably the greatest honor that maybe I've ever had, is to help another person change their life so that they can be somebody different. So with that, I'd like to thank you for having me here today and here for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Evangelist. Please stick around if there's any questions. Members, there is also written testimony from James Strom in the member packets. Member questions, Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Elise. Elise, I hope I'm saying that right. When you gave your testimony earlier, you kind of jogged my memory on something, and I just wanted to ask you about it. We had asked, the legislature had asked for a recap on how $500,000 that was appropriated to the Veterans Defense Project in 2017 was utilized. And I haven't seen that recap. If there is one and I've just missed it, I'd love to have you send it to me, or if you can tell me whether that has been done yet or not.
Mr. Ellis.
Thank you. Yes, that we submitted a report, and I know that it was also looked at and cleared by the legislative auditor, but I'd be happy to send you the materials. I just need to know where to send it. I'll ask Representative Feist to hook me up with that.
Representative Poston.
Very good, Mr. Ellis. I appreciate it. I would like to see that. And again, it may just be something that I have missed. So thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Feist, for bringing this bill. I think it will be coming, I imagine, to public safety again. I think we've heard it there in numerous years and have been supportive. Just such a critical piece of legislation that people inherently, if you assume people inherently are good and that people inherently need a second chance because we all make mistakes. But what our laws do, and I think the testifier, Christopher, it was a really good example, is if you make one bad choice, it follows you for, I mean, the DHS background checks, because he has a social work degree, 15 years, and sometimes more than that. So I just want to thank you, Representative, for bringing this, because it's for people that serve our country, for people with traumatic brain injuries. We have this struggle in our criminal justice system in general, and it's hard, and we really have to take a look and give grace and be honest with ourselves about what we actually want to see for our veterans. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Allison. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and as in the past, I have co-authored this bill. You know, when Chair Eklund was the main author of the bill, and it's gone through a lot of ups and downs over as we've gone through the process, which is typical for the legislative process sometimes. But I think a lot of times the legislative process will iron out things that need to be ironed out, and we'll have a good bill. And I think the concept of House File 478 is good. And I've sat in on veterans courts in Ramsey County. I've sat in. I've been in the back room with the lawyers and the judge talking about the cases that were coming up. And it's an eye-opening experience. And I've been to graduations in Ramsey County and also at Washington County. And we would like to see veterans courts expanded through the other counties. Some counties can combine with other counties. But we need to realize that House File 478 is not veterans courts. It's a helper for the veterans, and maybe to get them lined up to work with the veterans courts, and that's important. And because what we see with the testimony from the different veterans, I'm a veteran, I'm a 25-year veteran, I have twin sons that are West Point graduates. One has had four deployments, Iraq, Afghanistan. I have one deployed right now in Korea. That's his fifth deployment. They're identical twins. And I know when I came back after a two-year deployment, right after 9/11, I was sitting around the house, and my wife finally said, "You got to get up off your butt and get back to doing things." So I know what a lot of veterans go through, but I have a question for the author. You know, veterans courts do not allow offenders convicted of violent crimes to be included. Does this bill allow violent crimes offenses to be included?
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this bill, I'll let Mr. Else respond more substantively, but this bill currently permits crimes of violence to be included, but crimes of violence is actually much broader than it sounds, and it includes like certain drug offenses. And so it includes only crimes with a severity level up to level 7. So it's not for very serious crimes of violence, or violent crimes. But I'll let Mr. Else respond probably more thoroughly than I have.
Mr. Else.
Yes. Representative Detmer, I mean this as respectfully as I can possibly say it. You're wrong. I entered a veteran into the Ramsey County Veterans Court this morning on a second-degree assault with a firearm in a domestic setting, and he's receiving a stay of adjudication. I've had veterans in Hennepin County on the same charge, which is the right from the highest and a mandatory minimum prison sentence offense. And that is a common offense in veterans courts. Veterans come home, like the veteran that I entered into the Ramsey County Court this morning. He said to me, you know, you get used to the idea that you're taught to show a weapon before you use it. And if you do that here, that's called second degree assault with a firearm. That is a violent crime. And that goes into many veterans courts. They receive a stay of adjudication as the VRJA would do. So it's just simply not correct that crimes of violence do not enter veterans courts at this point.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Elsie. Another question, maybe either for the author or for Mr. Elsie, because I think Mr. Elsie is well informed on veterans courts and also on the House File 478. State law allows the court to extend the offender's probation term to complete court-ordered treatment. Is this in the bill?
Mr. Els.
That it's not needed in the bill because it is a term of probation under any this is not an exception to normal probation. It is a sentencing structure. So once the veteran's on probation, the term of probation would be determined by law, which we now have a few versions floating between the Senate and the House. And so I'm unsure if this version actually articulates that exactly, but it does not. The version in the Senate does. That was a problem that was raised by Ken Backus in the Senate, and we made it explicit, even though we agreed that that provision by statute would come into play anyways because they are on probation.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, these are just some questions that we've probably heard in the past that, maybe as this bill moves forward, it will probably go to where is it going from here? Public safety, Mr. Chair?
Goes to judiciary, Mr. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe some of these questions and some of these things, like the one I just asked, maybe it could be included with the bill. I think that would solve some of the issues that come up in different committees. And how is another question, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Elsie, or the author? How is treatment handled if there is no treatment program in the area where the offender lives?
Mr. Elsie.
That's a problem that has come up in quite a few of our veterans courts. Often the veteran needs to transport themselves. The inpatient program is most of the time at the St. Cloud VA. There are some programs now at the Minneapolis VA. And of course, there's a whole lot of veterans that don't live in St. Cloud or Minneapolis. They have to go and live at that facility while they do that inpatient program. The outpatient programming, a lot of it now is done via Zoom and other video methods. And I know there are a lot of smaller, what are they calling them, vet centers that are opening up within the community. But just like any other obligation, the veteran often has. The bill does have one feature I think is very nice, is the ability to shift jurisdiction from the county of offense to the county in which the veteran lives for the supervision. That we had a veteran that committed his offense while he was down in Stillwater. He lived up on the northern end of the Iron Range. And so he was having to drive for 4 hours to get to veterans court. And in that case, we transferred his supervision to the probation agents in St. Louis County. We thought that would be something that would make it much more convenient and more likely that they can comply with treatment and supervision when they need to, for example, take a urine analysis test on short notice, which is a pretty standard thing in these veterans courts. So that's one feature that I think will hopefully pass through and will set as the stage for these veterans to succeed.
Oh, we froze up. Thank you, Mr. Ellis. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe one more question here is, you know, when putting this bill together, I know it's been, what, 3 years? Maybe 3 years that this bill was worked on and been putting together. Was this bill put together in coordination with the state courts that oversee veterans courts? Did the veterans courts have some over, but did, were they able to have some input in coordinating this this legislation that is supposed to be out there supporting our veterans and maybe steering them towards the veterans courts and having that support for them? Was the courts included in this?
Mr. Ellis.
Yes, as I'm sure you know, Representative Detmer, the judicial branch has it does a lot to prevent judges from directly participating in the crafting of legislation that they will then be ruling on. So we had multiple judges and a court of appeals judge who worked on the early stage of our working group. And once it became clear that the legislative path was the best way to address this problem, they had to remove themselves from working on it. But we did have the participation of the County Attorneys Association representing all the prosecutors that handle felony level offenses, the chief public defender, and then we ran the bill by Violence Free Minnesota, who works with domestic violence victims. They supported it. We talked to the probation agents and social workers through the Social Workers Association, and they approved it. So we consulted with everyone we could. The judicial branch itself is, of course, a little more difficult.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would hope that, you know, somehow that we would get a stamp of approval on a piece of legislation that is so important for our veterans, for our veteran community, that I think that would solve a lot of problems that we have right now. I know there are some issues that have to be worked out in committees as we go forward, but I really feel that we are going to get a piece of legislation through this year. I really believe that, and I hope that it will be able to go through the committee process here in the House and the Senate and get it going forward. I'll see if there's other questions by other people, but again, those testifiers that came forward today, you know, thank you for your service. And I know that you believe in veterans courts because you have experience with it. And I hope that we can come forward some legislation that will give that support even more. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman.
Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate to what Representative Detmer said. The folks in particularly, and I hope I don't butcher your name, Mr. Olfertz and Mr. Hinman, who telling your story. I got my start as a public defender, and I know that when folks end up in criminal court, it's usually at the worst point in their lives. And so telling the story and coming here to help us improve systems and provide the supports and the interventions that folks need, I really just greatly appreciate, and I think is really important. And I would just say I am in full support of this, and this is an investment and an intervention that is good for our veterans and provides them what they need. It's also good for our communities, and it's good for the bottom line. And so I can't think of I'm new here, so I'm not sure why it's taken us so long, but I hope we get this passed this year. And I also just want to thank you, Mr. Leeds, for really advocating for it, because I know that the work that lawyers are doing in veterans courts and others are really important to that too. So thank you. I'm looking forward to voting for this, and I'm hoping we can pass it this year.
Members, seeing there's no other comments, I think the testimony is pretty clear that this is not a veterans court bill. It provides a platform to help serve our veterans that find themselves on the wrong side of the law for level 7 offenses and below. And I'm certainly hopeful that this will keep moving forward. Representative Feist, closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. And I'd just like to thank again the testifiers who came and shared their stories about the impact that veterans courts have had on their lives. I believe this is such an important bill. It is good for public safety, as Representative Greenman said, it's good for the bottom line. And as Representative Adelson said, we should allow grace for these veterans who have been charged with these low-level crimes and allow them the opportunity to confront, to take personal responsibility for their actions and to seek and receive the treatment that they really deserve. I'm just very excited about this bill and what it can do for our veterans and our community. Thank you.
I will renew my motion that House File 478 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Yes.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, I'll be voting aye. And I just hope that we can make some changes as we go forward. Thank you.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, no.
McDonald, no. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
Yes.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman. Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. And there are 12 ayes, 1 nay.
Grace, Representative McDonald changes from aye to...
Representative McDonald.
Representative McDonald changes from nay to aye.
McDonald, aye. And there are 13 ayes, 0 nays.
Being 13 yes and 0 noes, the motion is approved, and you're on your way to Judiciary and Finance, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I say something, Mr. Chair?
Well, we're running real quickly on time, Representative Feist, so very quickly.
Yes, I just wanted to let Representative Detmer know that he's welcome to reach out
no.
to me. I would be... What? Oh, somebody was not muted. Just definitely feel free to reach out to me, Representative Detmer. I'd be happy to talk about the issues that you have, and we can work on them. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Feist. But question, is there...
Quickly,
is
Representative Detmer, please. We've got two more bills to try to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a bill in the Senate that supports this bill?
Nice. Representative Detmer, there is one. Senator Chamberlain has a bill. It's got a couple technical differences on it.
Okay.
Third bill on the agenda today is House File 585. Representative Sandstead, I will move that House File 585 be referred to the General Register. Representative Sandstead, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, members. House File 585 is a bill that makes technical changes to the Minnesota GI Bill. I do have a small oral amendment to make a correction on a typo in this bill draft. If you would look at page 6, line 8, my proposal is to delete the word forced and insert forces. Could someone please make that motion?
First off, Representative Sandstead, I will ask Mr. Devo if he will comment on that as our nonpartisan staff. Mr. Devo.
Mr. Chair and members, it's pretty straightforward. I think it's a technical amendment to the bill in the shape of the author intended it to be introduced.
Thank you, Mr. Deal. I'll move that technical amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Two-year bill, Representative Sandstedt, as amended.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. The Minnesota GI Bill was established in 2007 to offer financial assistance to veterans in approved higher education programs with the goal of helping them enter a rewarding career. Over the years, the program has been enhanced to include on-the-job training, apprenticeship programs, and costs associated with professional licensure or certification. When these bills were added, the eligibility requirements under the GI Bill weren't clearly distinguished from the original higher education component, and this led to some ambiguity about how much assistance as a veteran was entitled, or how much assistance a veteran was entitled to. This bill corrects these ambiguities and makes other technical changes to update eligibility requirements for educational and training benefits. I'd appreciate your support. I also have one testifier with me today, Mr. Dave Bellify, Director of Veteran Education and Employment Programs at the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs.
Mr. Bellify, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, representative. My name is Dave Bellify. I'm the Director of Veteran Education and Employment Programs at the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And representative did a perfect background on the reason for these technical changes. I've been around since we started this program and have overseen this program for a number of years. And as she mentioned, we've added different avenues, but the language maybe didn't keep up with the addition, so it created a slight ambiguity, and these technical changes will resolve that. And Representative, thank you for pointing out line item 6.8 with that amendment. I was also going to point that little technical error out, but that's been resolved. I'm open to any questions on this. I know we're short of time. It does not expand eligibility for anyone, nor does it hinder eligibility for anyone. We're simply making technical changes as mentioned.
Thank you for your testimony. Any member questions on Bill 585? I'm not seeing any. Representative Sandstedt, thank you for bringing this bill forward. Any final comments?
Thank you, members. I would appreciate your support.
Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Mr. Chair, you want to renew the motion so we're not
wrong? I apologize. I am getting ahead of myself trying to get done here. I will renew my motion to House File 585 be referred to the General Register. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Yes.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Aye.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, aye.
McDonald, aye. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Come on. Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. And there are 13 ayes, 0 nays.
Representative Sandstedt, with 13 ayes and 0 nays, you're on your way to the General Register. Thank you for presenting today.
Thank you.
Members, House IT has let us know that we have a couple extra minutes, so we'll get this final bill done so we do not have to wait till next week. I will be turning the gavel over to Vice Chair Zhang.
All right. Final bill on the agenda today is House File 752. From Representative Eklund. Representative Eklund moves that House File 752 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Eklund, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill makes several changes regarding qualifications and terms for the Adjutant General for the Minnesota National Guard and the process for selecting the new Adjutant General. I have a couple testifiers today, and Mr. Chair, so if you would call Mr. Kerr and then Lieutenant Colonel David Blomgren to explain the merits of the bill.
All right, Mr. Kerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Don Kerr. For the record, I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. We also have Lieutenant Colonel Blomgren along in case there are any technical questions. He's our staff judge advocate. But I think I can give an overview of the bill, and we'll move with that. So as you all know, we went through a selection process for a new adjutant general here in the last summer. That's the second one in relatively quick succession. And in consultation with the governor's office, we felt this was an opportune time to take care of some of the things we felt were kind of clunky about existing law with regard to qualifications of the adjutant general, and also the automatic ascension of the deputy adjutant general in the event that the adjutant general were to leave abruptly. As we went through this process, we found a couple of things that we had concerns about as we looked at things that had happened in other states as well. For example, in the state of Wisconsin, their governor had to appoint a new adjutant general when their former adjutant general was called out for some things that required investigation. And the governor in Wisconsin determined that there was really nobody serving in the National Guard who hadn't been tainted by the command climate of the previous adjutant general. And so the governor of Wisconsin actually chose to go outside the Wisconsin National Guard and made a selection from the Air Force Reserve to be the adjutant general of Wisconsin. Although we aren't super concerned about that happening in Minnesota, we also couldn't rule that out, and we felt this was a good time to adjust the language, which previously had really been heavily slanted toward really allowing the governor only to select an officer who had been long serving in the National Guard. And so we made those changes in subdivisions 1 and 2, striking the requirement for 20 years of service in the Minnesota National Guard to be eligible for promotion to major general. So again, working with the governor's office, we identified, we also put a string on how long the governor can sit with the position vacant. And I will tell you, in all the things that we went through with this, we had a real mind toward the not allowing the adjutant general's position in Minnesota to become politicized. That is, keeping it aligning with the term of a sitting governor. Minnesota, we have a great tradition here of not having a politically aligned adjutant general, and that's the way we like it. I will tell you, that's not true in every state, and we feel our National Guard is much stronger because of that. We also took the opportunity to add a provision clarifying that the adjutant general is only eligible for a single term appointment. Other states have shorter terms but allow for multiple appointments, and we felt that we just needed to clarify that. And as I stated earlier, with regard to the ascension of the deputy adjutant general, it's already in law that the deputy adjutant general becomes the adjutant general should the adjutant general become incapacitated. But it wasn't clear if there were any steps that had to occur in the process, and we just kind of clarified that and also changed a reference that previously aligned with the way that deputy commissioners are appointed in other committee or in other agencies. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will submit for any questions that the committee may have.
Any further comments from Lieutenant Colonel Blomgren?
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for hearing this bill. As expected, Mr. Kerr did a fabulous job at explaining the rationale for the proposed bill. So I will be available for any questions.
All right, thank you. Any member questions or comments? Representative Raleigh?
Thank you, Chair. To the testifiers or to the author, how many O6s do we currently have in the Minnesota National Guard?
Mr. Kerr?
Mr. Chair, there are Representative Raleigh, there are in excess of 40 serving O6 colonels in the National Guard, plus there are an additional anywhere from 7 to 10 serving brigadiers or major generals in the Minnesota National Guard. Quite a change from the situation 100 years ago when the law was originally written.
Right, oh, that's wrong? Exactly. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. And I don't think the bill has it in there, but is there a consideration for a recently retired officer that may be called back into the National Guard, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Kerr?
Mr. Chair and Representative Raleigh, any officer who is eligible for reappointment, so if they were below the age of 60, they would be eligible for reappointment in the National Guard if they were recently retired, and they could also come from another service component and be appointed in the National Guard. One of the reasons we left 120 days in there is that would allow a governor to go through a selection process, and even though the law says you must be a member of the National Guard, that would give us enough time to have an officer selected and be appointed into the National Guard should the governor choose to select someone from outside serving members in the National Guard.
Representative Raleigh?
Mr. Chair, I'm satisfied and I support this bill.
All right. Seeing no further comments or questions, Representative Eklund, any final comments on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the indulgence. This is mostly a bill to make sure it doesn't happen again or as has happened elsewhere. So I think it's a good bill moving forward. I ask for your support.
All right. And Representative Eklund renews his motion that House File 752 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And then I'll pass it back to Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Vice Chair Zhang. Members and staff, our next meeting is next Tuesday. We are scheduled to have three bills before us this day. And I want to remind you that we have 90 minutes for each committee meeting, so editorial comments sometimes should be limited when necessary.
Chair, do we need to take a vote on that last bill?
Tabled.
Members laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Any other questions? With that, we'll see you next Tuesday. We are adjourned.